Welcome, everyone, to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I'm your host, Paul Niefer, and today we're going to join in a conversation with Chase DeWitz from Steele, North Dakota, and he's also the 2020 Horizon Award winner from Top Producer Magazine. Chase, how are things going in North Dakota today?
Oh, a little warm today. We're getting on the dry side. It'd be nice to get some moisture, but I guess can't complain too much. So,
yeah, no, out in our area, we had a lot of moisture this spring, but about a week and a half ago, it started turning really hot. I think we had 112 we peaked out at, but these days it's been in the high 90s, low 100s, which for this time of year for us is very normal. So, we're not complaining about that right now, but it was nice that we didn't get it a month ago when the crops were ripening up. So that was good. So, Chase, on these podcasts, we always like to sort of go into your background, where you grew up, went to college, how you got started in farming. So let's go ahead and start with that.
So my background, I guess, has always been agriculture. I'm on the farm. I grew up on that farm was homesteaded by my grandmother's parents, I believe in 1887, 88, somewhere in there. So that's the original homestead. So I grew up there, was a cow-calf operation, did do some farming at that time in North Dakota. It was primarily just small grains or raising feed for the livestock, it seemed. At that time, my dad and his brother farmed in a partnership, and that's just kind of how things were structured. And I graduated high school in 2002, went to 1 year of college at, Bismarck State College, which is about 40 miles from the farm in Bismarck. I only went to one semester college. I kind of more of was learned by doing than by sitting in a classroom, which later in life I wish I would have had done more education, but that wasn't my mindset at the time. I went back to the farm, kind of more so on the cattle side, started doing some custom feeding of some cattle, built a feed yard, 2,500 head feedlot in 2005. That was an equip project that we had done. And that really kind of is what really got things going for me, just from the ability to cash flow, and kind of really started expanding from that point. To kind of put things in perspective, in 2002, when I graduated high school, the operation was about 180 beef cows, backgrounded them calves, and cropped about 800 acres. And fast forward 10 years from that to 2012, the operation was 1,250 beef cows with 2,500 head feedlot, and we were just about to 22,000 acres of crop. So extremely fast expansion. One of the reasons for that is there was a lot of expiring CRP land in the area, and a lot of it was actually very high quality land. It was just a lot of farmers that had retired in the 90s, lower grain price, low commodity prices, things like that. And a lot of that CRP expired on 10-year contracts kind of through that 2009 through about 2012 period. And so that really allowed for fast expansion kind of in that period. But
On the crop acres, what would be your primary crops in that area? I have a pretty good idea what they might be, I'm just curious what your primary crops are.
North Dakota has changed a lot, but for a number of years now, my primary crop by percentage of acres has been soybeans.
Okay.
Which would be 20 years ago would be unheard of, but
yeah,
primary crop year over year for a number of years has been soybeans, and from by acres, corn would be behind that, and then we do some small grains. I don't typically do much spring wheat. I do durum, barley for malt and feed barley, depending on the market. And then we do some rye too. So
Okay. Now, how much of your crops that you grow do you use to feed the livestock versus selling it to your other customers, I guess I would call it?
Not a lot. You know, the cow, both the feedlot and the cow calf operation are kind of, I don't know how to explain it. You know, we use a lot of aftermath. I mean, we do as much aftermath grazing as possible, especially on corn stalks in the fall, or a lot of the small grain ground will seed to rye and then fall graze the rye. Typically our rye, we will bale the straw on that. Maybe we'll do a little bit of barley straw or durum, depending on the harvesting conditions here. And, you know, in the feedlot, I'm not finishing any cattle. I'm just backgrounding cattle. So a lot more roughage type rations. So I'm not using a lot of corn. So really we're not actually using we're raising all the feedstuffs that we use. I don't buy any feedstuff other than some distiller grains or whatever for supplemental protein. But you know, by percentage of production, it's actually fairly minimal.
And then so steel, I looked on a map, it's about halfway between Bismarck and Jamestown, right on highway or I-94. As far as, you know, with the number of acres you have, how spread out are those acres for both the crop side and then maybe on the cattle side?
We're spread out about 40 miles. So, yeah, if you look at a map, our main farming operation is just 5 miles east of Steele, right off I-94. And then we actually don't go too far east from there. Kind of the land really changes there. It turns into a lot more irrigated ground, sandy ground. We do farm a little bit of irrigated ground, not much. I don't own any irrigated. We just rent some. There's a lot of potato production in that area.
Yep.
So we basically farm from there west. We do have another farm site location by Sterling, which would be about 23 miles to the west. We've got another farmstead there, which I guess we kind of reference as the ranch. That's primarily where all the cow-calf operation is at. And then we do have another a grain bin site over in that area too. So yeah, we kind of farm kind of actually from Steele west towards Bismarck, but we're spread out about 40 miles from furthest ends. So
that's not too bad. I mean, I've talked to other producers that have to go a lot farther than that for less acres than you're talking about.
And that is one of the things I kind of will reference 2012 as, I don't know if you'd say high water mark, but 2012 was kind of where I started transitioning. You know, I was young, extreme growth mode. Primary focus was just getting the work done, doing the production. The books was the backside.
Yeah.
Also, when things started peaking out, as anybody in agriculture knows, 13, 14, 15 was a much different environment than 10 through 12.
Yeah.
And, you know, at that time I probably was spread out 60, 70 miles. I actually, that 13 through 15 timeframe, actually contracted acres, tightened up my farming, the footprint, and kind of restructure, you know, kind of reorganize a little bit to be more efficient. We're farming about the same amount of acres again now as we were in 12, but better ground, closer proximity, that kind of thing. So
what type of yields would you typically expect for like corn and soybeans in your area?
Well,
and I know that's a loaded question because Mother Nature in North Dakota can be pretty wild. So
yeah, and that's the struggle. I mean, You know, we can combine 180 to 200 bushel corn field after field, or we could chop the entire farm.
Yeah.
Because of complete failure, which is what we had last year. I mean, we had just devastating drought last year. I've combined single digit soybeans before, and I've combined soybeans that were running 55, 60 bushel. It just really is really variable.
Well, and this year, like you say, if you don't get a lot of moisture coming up, you know, the soybeans, they're starting to hit that stress period. So, you know, August is typically what makes soybeans. Now I know, you know, as you go north and south, if you go farther south, it's obviously going to be July. As you go farther north, it's more like August or coming up right now. So, And then when do you typically start harvest as far as, do you start beans first and then corn, or is it corn and then beans? Because it's variable around the country. I know that.
Well, I mean, for us right now, we've harvested our rye. We tried a little bit of barley yesterday. It's just too wet yet, which is a little late, but we got in the field a little late this year with all the moisture we had in April and early May.
Yep.
I'm guessing next week we'll be into the barley pretty heavy. We're actually going to go desiccate the Durham probably Sunday, Monday here. And, you know, that'll probably be the end of probably that following week we'll be into that. Typically soybeans, usually that third, fourth week of September can get started on soybeans. Usually the first week of October typically is full on soybean harvest, but you know, that just kind of depends, and that depends a lot too when, you know, when we get a frost too. But
you know, out in our area, I was telling you beforehand, you know, we had a drought last year. Our crop was about 40% below normal, and then this year we've had record rainfall and we're probably 10, 20, 30% above normal. And Mother Nature, sometimes it takes it away and sometimes it gives it back. I was out riding the combine with my cousins a couple of days ago, and that field did about 140. So I think we're going to see quite a few 150, 160, 170 this year on wheat. So we're sort of out in the productive part of the southeastern Washington state. So it's pretty nice. But now I know that, like you said in your conversation there a little bit, that, you know, you were trying to get the work done and sort of the bookkeeping, the back office sort of was, you know, not quite as important, but I think you've tried to maybe come up with a little bit better accounting, accrual accounting, and so on. Go through those details for our listeners.
You know, as I referenced, that was kind of the transition point. I mean, it just and I had just some other circumstances too. I also got divorced in that period too, so that obviously made financial things tougher too. And then going into 13, 14, 15 and just completely different dynamics. And I just, you know, kind of was just running and kind of everything just kind of came to a headwind. And I had actually two different people that I got involved with, one who was a retired banker in agricultural lending his entire life, worked for Farm Credit Northwest, and then had gravitated back to North Dakota where he was originally from. And then another guy who worked kind of part-time for a firm similar to what you work for, and had them guys kind of help me restructure everything, what I needed to do, and did things on their recommendations. And you know, just kind of had to reset from a financial perspective. You know, I didn't, you know, didn't file a bankruptcy or anything like that. I just had to internally restructure and kind of basically catch my finances up with my growth that had happened. And you know, and we got through that period and kind of restructured some staffing and had to focus and get better on that. I'm not to that point of accrual accounting where I'd like to be. I probably the biggest struggle there is just struggled with finding the right person for that. My wife was doing some of that, and now she's actually just graduated this spring as a nurse practitioner. So her career is, she's occupied with her career, so that I haven't been able to completely fill that role to the extent that I would like to. But we're definitely on top of our books then, a lot better than I ever was previously. But I'm not to that that goal of accrual accounting where I can know where we're at any given period or any given day. But I definitely know within a, within a percentage or, a rational level. But
well, and I don't think, I think even those that have true accrual accounting, you're still always, there's always estimates. I mean, there's always things that you have to decide, do you want to get down to the gnat's eyelash? Well, that sounds great until you find out you spend $10,000 to get down to the gnat's eyelash. So you have to be practical and so on. Now, going back, and I forgot to ask at the beginning, so you graduated high school, got started with the 2,500 head feedlot, but your dad and his brother were in a partnership. How is that? Are you involved with your dad, not involved with your dad? I'm sort of curious how that is.
So my dad farmed with his brother, and who was 10 years older than him. So it was kind of a dynamic, just kind of the way it gravitated because the age, his brother kind of was the boss per se. And then my cousin, who was 10 years older than me, came back to the operation in, I think it was 1998 or 99. And at that time, they actually split up their partnership. There was no family conflict or anything. It was just, that was just kind of the direction. They split up their partnership. And my dad will kind of reference there that he got like a 2-year or 3-year window there that he actually got to be his own boss. And then I just took everything over, but to some extent that kind of how things did go a little bit, but yeah, my dad, he still helps, not quite so much on a daily basis. My mom actually just retired here in 1st of June, and, they have a house up in Bismarck as well, and they probably stay there a few, maybe once or twice a week or something. And so he's kind of gravitating more towards a part-time basis, but he still comes and helps. But I actually financially bought them out last year. He still actively farms his rented ground yet, but as far as all the owned ground, I actually bought that from them last year. And then he still owns some equipment, and I'm doing a buying that out, what he still owns for equipment on them slowly. So
okay. And so really, it's pretty much your operation, but he helps out when he likes to, or when you need him, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, he does. Not maybe so much on the grain production side. He'll help some. They're not real heavily involved in there. Maybe more so on the livestock and some of the haying and things like that. So.
And over on your livestock, so you have about, I think, about 1,200 head, 1,200 cows. Is that right?
Yeah, we're usually right around about 1,250 cows is what we have. So.
And that's an Angus Simmental mix, or what type of mix are you doing?
Angus Simcross. Probably more so Angus. I do bring in some Simmental genetics on, our half blood bulls or whatever, but trying to keep the cows more Angus based. So.
Okay. And then you also background some other ones, some more head besides what you raised yourself.
Yeah, I primarily I'll buy some calves in the fall. Typically, hadn't done much for custom feeding the last number of years. We did do some again this year, or this past winter we had in the spring. Yeah, and then I just background them up there, and then I will retain ownership on some cattle and send them down to Nebraska to finish. So
okay. And then I think as far as employees, you have full-time employees, also have some part-time employees. Let's go into how that looks for an operation.
Yeah, so right now we have I guess right now I got five full-time employees, and then we also employ H2A labor employees too, which we currently have seven H2A employees, which are all South African native. I've been doing the H2A program since 2007, actually, so I've been in it for quite a number of years. I guess one thing, I don't have a single H2A employee there that hasn't worked for me for more than 2 years, so that helps. I got some guys that have worked for me almost 10 years already, so that helps a lot with the H2A labor. So
yeah, it's interesting, you know, out in our part of the woods, you know, for the H2A workers out here, which are primarily going to be in the fruit and the vegetable area, are almost exclusively in the fruit side. They're all, you know, Hispanics from either Mexico or Central America. Whereas on the crop side, at least the ones I've come across, it's almost invariably from South Africa. So it's just interesting to see the differences, and you know, and they seem to be pretty good workers. You know, they really appreciate what they're doing, and they do a fairly good job.
Yeah, and I guess not to divulge into this too much, but I, you know, if somebody looking at that, you know, for labor, is, you know, labor is just such a wide issue pretty much among every industry, as we all all know right now. But I would recommend, you know, we do 100% internal recruiting. And the reason what I mean by that is, the only times we bring in, you know, if somebody decides that, you know, they're not coming back the next season, or we need an additional guy or whatever else, it's, they are recruited by the guys that already work there. And for one thing, it's an accountability thing. You know, you personally know this individual, because you really don't get an opportunity to interview this person. They can put whatever on a piece of paper on their CV of all this, and you have all this expense involved to get the individual to your operation, and you're basing it off of maybe one phone conversation with them and whatever they put on a piece of paper.
Yep.
And the thing is, and one of the downfalls of that program is, there is no, you know, if that individual comes to your operation and is there for a month and decides, well, this isn't for me, I'm going to go somewhere else, they can leave without any penalty repercussions whatsoever and jump ship and go to a different position. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you don't get that accountability aspect whatsoever, you know, where it's, okay, this is my cousin, or this is a friend of mine that I've known or whatever, well, then now they're kind of accountable because they know one or multiple individuals that already works there. And we've gone to that model for the last number of years, and that just works so much better.
Well, and then for our listeners out there that maybe are not aware of how the H2A program works, so you bring them in, how long are they here? What do you have to provide to them that maybe we don't provide to, you know, workers here that are based in the U.S.? So go through some of those details, because I think a lot of our listeners really probably are not that familiar with the H2A program.
So the way the H2A program is currently structured, it's a 10-month program. So the maximum they can be here is 10 months on one visa petition, where you will have some guys who will stay in the U.S. and transfer between petitions, you know, so you always have that 2 month gap, but then they can only consecutively can stay in the U.S. for a 3 year period. My guys all go back for that 2 month period and then come back again. Generally probably been staying about 9 months, but you know, the duration is 10. So you have to provide them housing. You know, there is a minimum wage rate that is set individual of each state. Every state has got a different wage. You know, I always start my guys out at the minimum wage, but, you know, year over year, they get increased. I don't have anybody that's on the minimum wage currently. And then, you know, and then you got to provide them a vehicle to drive and there's some technicalities with meal compensation or how much time they're supposed to have. And I guess we don't get too into the weeds on that, all them details, but you do have to, you know, technically they're supposed to pay their way to get here, and then you're supposed to reimburse them after they're so far into their contract. I just usually buy the tickets for them up front and then and just do it that way. But I mean, you do have to supply a lot of things, but you know, those guys are here, they're here to work, and they put in a lot of hours, but you know, and it just with everything, it comes down to the individual that you're employing, and you have to kind of gauge that of what works there. But I don't know. And like you said, I'm sure there's a lot of people that have explored it, but I would say too, if you have any interest in getting into the program, it's not a fast process. If you're going to be a new person to the program and you want to have employees for next spring, I would say you better start the process in the next 2 to 3 months.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, on the housing side, are they sort of like in a dorm, or do you provide an individual house for them? Out in our area, we've had people buy an old hotel and revamp it. We've had, you know, various ways of providing the housing. I'm just curious how you do it there in North Dakota.
I kind of got multiple. So we got two different farm sites we have people staying at. What I had did when we had the oil boom happened, you know, there was all kinds of, sorry, called bear type housing that was put up all over up in the northwest part of the state. And then when the bust happened, I mean, you could buy single wide trailer houses that were a couple of years old for literally nothing. And I had bought a number of them and set them up. So we've got a couple of those. And then I guess we got one shop. There's a living area in one of the shop buildings too that we use for housing. So.
Okay. Now, you have, you have three kids now, or how many kids do you have?
Yeah, but I've got twin boys that'll be 5 at the end of August here, and then my daughter will be 2 the end of November.
Okay, so I'm guessing she's got you wrapped right around her little finger, is that right?
Oh, yeah. she rules the roost. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I have 2 grandkids, a girl that's 3.5, and then a boy that's 1.5, and then we have another grandson on the way. And believe me, the 3.5-year-old granddaughter, we're just living in her world. I mean, we're at her beck and call. So
yeah, no doubt.
Do you think, I know it's way too early, and I'm sure they love being on the combine or the tractor with dad, but what's your plan, you know, 15, 20 years from now for when they might be coming back to the farm?
You know, that's something I often think about. Couple things. I am going to make them leave the farm. I will not allow them to graduate high school and start farming.
Yep.
They have to go do something, whether you go to college or you go work somewhere else. They got to leave the farm, because I just think back to myself. I dedicated myself to the farm so heavy just right off the bat. And you got to go do something else, whether they go to college, they go get another job, they go military, whatever they may do, you have to leave. I am not going to let you just come back to the farm.
Yeah.
You have to go do something else. And, you know, and who knows, maybe all three of my children might not have any interest in the farm, or potentially all three might, you know, I'll have to dictate that how it goes. You know, as far as, you know, long-term planning goes, I if one or multiple comes in the operation, and I'll push for responsibility onto them pretty quickly at that point, and ownership. I'm not going to be the 80-year-old farmer out there that has, the 40-year-old child that's been just working for you that doesn't own anything. I mean, yeah. I'm gonna move things over to their ownership as quickly as fit, but also I'm not just gonna give them everything either.
Right.
I guess that's just something that I do think about that a lot. And then if you got one child farming, two that aren't, I have divested in enough other investments outside of agriculture that, I think I can, as they say, what is equal isn't always fair, but
right.
I think I could get to a point to where I could make things to a point to where it's divided up to some extent evenly, and just, I don't know. You just see too many families that get destroyed because of estate issues, and
right.
I just do not want that to happen, and just we'll be on the front end of planning of that, and not to say anything, I just, it seems like that generation that is, leaving us now, that age bracket, just, they hung on to everything forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of that, I think, leads back to, a lot of them grew up during the Depression years and things like that. They just absolutely do not, they don't let go. They would rather pass away than address the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, and I think as you get into maybe more so the baby boomers, say the people now that are in retirement age and a little older, I think they're doing a better job of planning and probably are actually retiring. That was the other thing about them, people from that, they all work till they're 80 years old.
Yeah.
They just never retired. And, I think you're seeing, as the generations call me, the quality of life is just becoming more of a thing where people just aren't, which you still have people like that. But I think it will get better with generational planning. It just, there's always going to be situations. There are always going to be, certain ones that are going to be that. But I think that is getting better, trending better, in my opinion. But, and I just see so much of that with so many different landlords and things like that, and just the wide variation you have of that. It's just, yeah, I don't know.
And I think, at least when I was reading the article in Top Producer, and I think as part of our conversation too, it appears that you're not really interested maybe in getting larger. I'm going to say you're trying to get better, and I know that's not the right word, but do you plan on expanding more or just making what you have better, or what's your maybe goals over the next 5 to 10 years?
So I would say my primary, expansion is not my primary objective. I mean, I would expand with the right opportunities. I guess the way I would like to expand would be through other people. And what I mean by that is, employees that either come in or employees that are already within the operation, having them take on some actively farming operations of their own. I had an employee who was, we were starting that process more so on the livestock side, and actually very tragically June 28th he was killed in an accident, and 24 years old. Terrible deal. And we were starting that process, that the rest of my US full-time employees are either at later half of their career that don't have their interest to do that, or just don't really want the risk.
Yeah.
You know, but that is where I would like to go more so, is that myself, I farm enough. I don't need to farm more, but not to say that my equipment can't go over more, but I want another individual to be having that, you know, that ownership of that, that's their crop and whatever else, and having that more, you know, collaborative farming with that individual. That yep. That's more so the direction that I want to go. I just you know, just haven't, I have one employee, a younger individual, that actually just had this conversation with him yesterday evening about a piece of ground that was coming available for rent, and if he was interested in taking that piece of ground as his to start farming. So that's more so what I'm trying to do. So.
Okay. And then also, I think in the article you had mentioned that you are thinking about going away from the trend of equipment ownership to equipment leasing. Have you explored that further? Because I know this article is a couple of years old, but I was just curious.
Well, that was, you know, late 19, early 20. You know, that kind of operate with the current supply chain, that yeah. opportunity is completely gone. You know, yeah. I actually did early 2020 when the world was coming to an end, or I guess, you know, March 2020, we actually did lease a number of units. It was very attractive at that time to do that. And, you know, those units now are locked in at very good lease rates. And I think the way equipment is gone, I'll probably end up actually buying out the leases on them when they expire.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just because of the way the appreciation has been with the equipment.
Yeah.
Anything since then that we've actually been able to get has all been purchased. I don't even know if I haven't even looked at the leases. That the sales people have just pretty much said that it there's just the numbers just absolutely don't work just because the availability of things.
Yeah. Now, are you all green, all red, all yellow, or are you a mix of different colors?
We're all green now. I have had some red equipment in the past, but and nothing against the red equipment. I just went all green just because of their operations center platform. And, you know, I do have, had about a year and a half ago, I did hire a guy that is responsible for all our field data, tracking and tracking all the grain inventory and, input product inventory. So we have made a huge advancement from that side. I need to find an individual that can do the same thing from the financial side to get us to that accrual accounting point. And he's, you know, extremely tech savvy and manages all of that, and we're using a few different platforms. You know, like when we're delivering grain, they can scan a grain ticket into an app, apply it to a bin it came from, apply it to a contract, communicates with our operations center as far as the grain coming out the field, where it's being stored. And we've gotten to a point where a lot of that is really actually communicating on its own, but, you know, you still have to manage that. And he's doing that. And that's probably where I struggle a little bit, probably mostly due to my lack of patience. Me and technology sometimes have a hate love relationship. So.
Well, I'm right there with you. I've been accused many times of not being the most patient person, and so I share your pain on that end.
Yeah. No, but. But yeah, what other questions do you have?
Well, Chase, I always end with a couple questions. This has been a great conversation so far, but let's go ahead and end with my two questions I always try to ask my farmers. And the first question is what keeps you up at night? Is it the weather? Is it something else? I'm just wondering what do you stew on at nighttime once in a while?
You know, to be perfectly honest with you, I actually sleep pretty good. I always tell my wife it's clear conscience, and then she kind of balks at that. But I don't know. Probably what would cause me to lie awake and much at night is probably probably labor, actually. You know, you know, managing employees is just such a, I think it's a lot more of an art than a skill.
Yeah.
And you know, I kind of just always second guess myself sometimes, and you're always, you know, trying to figure out where to place everybody per se in the right seats on the bus, or you got, you know, an internal conflict between two employees or something you're trying to address, and just, you know, it just you're kind of constantly delegating that. And yeah, that probably is something that is probably one of my higher level stress points.
I can understand that perfectly. And then my last question is always, what is your definition of success in farming?
I mean, that's an intriguing question. You know, I'll probably revert that back to what I view as what makes me happy. And I guess, you know, when, you know, there's a couple combines running down a field and combining or, you know, harvesting whatever crop it may be. And it's just like, I don't know, to me, it just seems when things are just flowing and I mean, that's what I view as my picturesque version of agriculture is kind of that. I guess I wouldn't measure it so much in the way of, you know, money in the bank or anything like that. I just kind of, yeah. I guess, you know, harvest is an enjoyable time for me, especially when you have good production, but just kind of seeing that process and just enjoying and seeing that happen, I guess, and progress. I mean, I like to see progress. You know, I love to see a field that you know may have taken over 5 years ago or something, wherever be, and making improvements to that field and seeing the production improve on it, or you know, or you know, things like that. I guess I enjoy to see progress. But
yeah. Well, and I'm right there with you. My favorite activity on the farm is to ride on the combine, whether I'm operating it or not. I don't care. Matter of fact, this afternoon I actually have to do a 4-hour seminar today on estate planning for farmers. But after that, I'm going to go ride the combine for 2 or 3 hours and then head home. And that's my idea of almost bliss. That's what I look forward to. So,
okay. Yeah.
Well, Chase, thank you very much for taking some time out of your day, and maybe in the future we'll touch base again and see how things are going.
All right, sounds good. It was fun. So,
okay, thanks, Chase. And again, this is the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I am Paul Neefe, your host, signing off.
Get timely updates about taxation, accounting, succession planning, and other issues that are unique to farmers and agribusiness processors. Find out about major agribusiness events and how to comply with new laws that affect your business. Subscribe to Farm CPA at blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness and experience the CLA promise. blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness.
My buddy Kyle here is going to help me tell you about Corteva
and
the power of
and.
You see, Intrepid Edge insecticide combines fast knockdown
and
lasting residual activity for proven results.
And
it has two modes of action that deliver effective control against robbing insects, like leaf miners
and
armyworms
and
corn borers
and
loopers
and.
Oh, lunchtime.
Thanks, Kyle.
And
visit intrepidedge.corteva.us to learn more.